Pretty slick. Yeah. Hi, everyone. You know, some musical sets take it out of me more than others. That was one of the others. Man. Yeah. In a good way. You know, Jeff variously introduces me as the token normie of the group here. And whenever anyone calls you a normie, the first thing that you need, of course, to ask is, compared to what? And, you know, if we're going to narrowly define normie as someone who's not an addict or an alcoholic, okay, I guess I fit that. But as compared to all that a human being could be or should be, I don't even think I'm in the same room with normie. And, man, when I look back at my life, I think my entire decade of my 20s was lived in just a black, depressive haze, and my early 30s as well. And it took a while for me to start to see there was a different way to live life. You know, by the time I was in my early 30s and my first marriage broke up and my life was in the toilet and I was really thinking about suicide being a great alternative, something clicked that there had to be more than everything that I had experienced and everything that I had been trying to do for the past so many years. Just last week, an email popped into my inbox, and it was a girl that I had dated, good grief, I'm going to date myself here, in the mid-70s, when we were on a musical tour, and I have not talked to this woman, I kid you not, in 30 years, and that's a scary thing to be able to say. I haven't talked to her in 30 years, and she got my email from a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, and just wanted to say hi. And so, you know, we exchanged emails, and I sent her links to The Effect and links to Children of the Americas, and of course, there's all sorts of pictures and all of those links, and she emailed back and said that even in the pictures, she could see a change because the person that she remembered was darker, is the way she put it. The person she remembered was moody. The person she remembered had this cloud hanging over his head. And she could look in these pictures and see something different. That was a great thing to hear. Because, you know, as much as we try, it's really hard to see transformation in ourselves. When I listen to Lisa's story, or I listen to Jeff's story, Bubba's story, you know, anybody's story of their previous life, the only person I know is the one that's standing in front of me now. I didn't know them then. Jana, same thing. I look at Jana's face and I can't believe the stories I hear about her past. It just does not compute. It can't be the same person. Something has happened in her, right? Yeah. A transformation has taken place. She is not the same person that she was. I am not the same person I was. And even though I didn't act out with alcohol or drugs, I acted out in all sorts of different ways as I was trying to outrun my personal demons, let me tell you. And so when I look back at that time and I think, why did it take me so long to figure out that there was a different way that I could live my life? What was the impediment? What was that thing that kept me? You know, there's a movie out right now, or it's coming out soon, I think, and part of the trailers is the director talking about the fact that this is his first R-rated movie, you know, and he's really proud of that. You know, he's going to go all out now because it's an R-rated movie. Did you know that R-rated movies really don't make that much money? You know what movies make all the money? G movies. Maybe PG. Why? Because the kids keep going and going and going. I've got a 3-year-old. He can watch the same thing 18 times in a row, and the 18th time is just as good as the first time. Wouldn't that be great? He never seems to get tired of these things. It's the G movies that make the money, and yet, why do they want to keep making R-rated movies? I heard a movie critic on the radio saying one time, it's because when the director makes an R-rated movie, he gets all the nice-looking chicks. When he makes a G movie, he gets to go home and, I guess, play reruns of Bambi or something. But there is a status, there is a coolness, there is a hipness, I guess, to angst in our culture. I mean, think about it. Who are the heroes that we seem to idolize? You know, going back a generation, it was Shane, and then it was James Bond, and now, I don't know, it's Batman or Fox Mulder of X-Files. But think about each one of those characters. They're dark. They're brooding. They're unsmiling. They have this past that they're carrying around like chains around their waist and over their shoulders. I mean, they're out to do good and save the world and do all that. But it's as if we have this love affair with this lonely, dark person, this drifter, like Clint Eastwood, who kind of rolls through town and saves things, and then you see his horse going off into the distance. You know, I think we love them as long as we can't have them, as long as we know they're just passing through our lives. But it's interesting, this love affair we have with angst, with anxiety, with darkness, with brooding. And I've been thinking about that a lot. There was another movie called Moscow on the Hudson, and probably most of you missed it, because I think everybody did, but Robin Williams was in it, and he played a Russian musician who was on tour to the United States, and he comes to New York, and he decides to defect. This is during the Cold War. And so he defects, he comes to this country, and now he's trying to live in New York, and he doesn't know what to do with himself. Suddenly, everything that defined his life, all the restrictions in Russia were lifted, and he had all this freedom, and he didn't know how to handle it. And he's miserable, and there's this one key scene where he's sitting in his room, and he says, "When I was in Russia, I hated my life, but I loved my misery." He said, "I loved my misery because it was my misery." He says, "I could hold it, I could caress it, it was mine. I loved my misery." Now think about that for just a second. Someone can take everything that you hold dear, and with it they can take your happiness, they can take your freedom, they can take your very joy, but nobody can take your misery. It's yours. For as long as you want it, it's yours. And the more they take, the more it's yours. And so, for as long as we see our happiness and our joy connected to external things, that is the truth. Our misery is the one thing that we can count on to never leave us. And so we hold on to it. We guard it with everything that we are. It becomes a part of our definition. And so we hold on to it because, in reality, we don't know how else to be. The misery has become so ingrained, so much a part of our every moment, our every decision, our every reaction to everything that comes around us, that we just stay there. There's a fascinating line in the first line of the novel Anna Karenina that goes like this. "Happy families are all alike. Unhappy families are all different. They're miserable or unhappy each in their own way." Does that sound true to you? Think about it. Happy families are all alike. Unhappy families are all unhappy in their own way. Yes, it's true. Because happy families are defined by love, and love has predictable effects. The effect of love in a family is respect, it's compassion, it's tenderness, it's civility, it's trust. And every happy family, every happy relationship has those characteristics because it's defined by love. Unhappy families are not defined by love, they're defined by the circumstances of the unhappiness of at least one member of that family. And so it's unique. Any of you who have teenagers, any of you who have been a teenager, know that teenagers are always saying, "Nobody understands me," right? "Nobody knows the pain that I'm going through. It's different this time." My teenager tells me the same thing. They're unique. But if the narcissism of the teenage years continues on and gets solidified in adulthood, that attitude stays. And you know what? It becomes part of that Batman-Superman complex where it's our misery, it's our unhappiness that sets us off, makes us unique, and lets us sit head and shoulders. It's cool to be that dark, brooding, cigarette-smoking person rather than the happy idiot over here in the corner who looks like everybody else. Another great line, I guess this is literature night, they just keep coming to my head. Milton, in his great Paradise Lost, has Satan saying, "It is better to rule in hell than to serve in heaven." You know what? On one level, we can understand that. Our rugged individuality as Americans, our need to succeed on our own, to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, all these things are combining to keep us where we are. And then you add to that the fear of the unknown, that the devil we know is preferable to the devil we don't know. All of this stuff is this toxic mix that makes us think this is where we're supposed to be. This is the way it is. This is the way I am, you know, and this is the way I'm going to be. Take me or leave me, but this is how I am. And so we don't even conceive of anything outside of this bubble of angst, that there's another there out there that is possible. There's another way to live. This is exactly what the first step is designed to lever into, to wedge into. It's designed to remove the source of angst because it's designed to remove the need that we feel for angst, which is what? When we love our misery, when we feel that we are ourselves because of this thing that we have built up around ourselves, we feel that we're in control. And that's the bottom line. When everything else is failing us, at least if we feel we've got some control, there's something to hold on to. And what does the first step tell us? We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, drugs, whatever it is, you name it. We admitted that we were powerless and that our lives had become unmanageable. What the first step is telling us is that that control that we ultimately seek, and we seek it through the mix of our lives, is really an illusion. What control do we really have? And see, we have to understand what the first step is really telling us, because if we think that we are going to voluntarily give up our control or give up our power, we got another thing coming. It doesn't work that way. Who voluntarily gives up power? Who voluntarily gives up control? You ever notice how when a tax goes into place, no matter what they say, it never goes away? You put a tax in place because of a proposition and it's supposed to be timed to this. Something happens. The tax stays there. When a law goes into place, it stays there. When a government goes into place, it stays there. People don't give up power voluntarily. There was a great story that a pastor used to tell about his young daughter when she was small. And for some reason, she loved to stand up at the dinner table. She was always standing up, and they're always telling her to sit down. She'd stand up, sit down. Every dinner was a fight. Finally, the pastor just had it. He put her in her place and made her sit down. And she's sitting there, and she's brooding at her plate. And finally, she looks up, and she says, "I may be sitting down on the outside, but on the inside, I'm standing up." You know, sometimes we think that giving up is the same as surrender. The first step is asking us to surrender. The first step is asking us to lay down our arms, seriously lay down our arms. And we think just giving up, just stopping the resistance, is the same thing. Giving up is the end of resistance, but surrender is the beginning of submission, and that's a very different thing. Giving up, if you just stop drinking, is that really the sum total of sobriety? If every day is a waking hell and you white-knuckle through it, and you're still thinking about every moment that you want that drink, you want that whatever, that's not what sobriety is about. Giving up is the end of resistance. But surrender is the beginning of submission, and it takes us into a whole new area. This is where Jesus is trying to get us. This is where the first step is trying to get us. This is where we've got to go. Y'all saw the movie The Matrix? There's a great scene that starts to illustrate what we're talking about here. The first Matrix. The other two were not so good. But the first one had a scene where the hero goes into a room with a bunch of kids who all can do these fantastic things. They're levitating balls and they're doing all these wonderful things. And he walks up to one who is holding a spoon and bending the spoon. And the child hands him the spoon. And so he's holding it. And the boy says to him, "Don't try to bend the spoon. That's impossible. Only try to see the truth." And he says, "What's that?" "There is no spoon." This is the same thing that's going on. It's impossible for us to voluntarily give up our control or give up our power. So don't try to give up your power. That's impossible. Only try to see the truth. What's that? You have no power. The only power you have is to choose a different direction. That's it. These external things that are crushing us down, these circumstances that we can't control, we're powerless over. But what the first step is asking us to do is to see the truth so that we can surrender to it, the truth that we don't have any power. Jesus said at John 8:32, he said, "If you continue in my word, then you are truly my followers. And then you will know the truth, and you all know the rest. And the truth will set you free." What truth? What is he talking about there? The word he used for truth in Aramaic is serara. That word means truth, but it means it in this sense. It means it in a right or harmonious direction. And more importantly, it means that which opens possibilities. The truth is that which opens possibilities and actually liberates. The truth Jesus is asking us to see. The truth that we will see if we follow his word and become his followers. The truth that the first step is asking us to see is the same thing that liberates us and the same thing that opens the possibilities of a new direction, a right and harmonious direction, a direction that doesn't include the misery that we carry around with us, a direction that we don't even know exists yet because we can't see that far. But that's what the first step is all about. That's what Jesus is talking about. Did you know that Jesus had a first step too? In the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7, the first line of what he says there is in a section called the Beatitudes. And the first Beatitude at Matthew 5, 3 is, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." Now, poor in spirit, what does that really mean? In Aramaic, it's an idiom. That means it's a saying that they use that has no real meaning in and of itself, but they understood it among themselves. Meskenai ruch, poor in spirit. What does it mean? It means someone who is humble. It means someone who is dependent. It means someone who has an attitude of poverty, even if they're rich. It means someone who has surrendered and someone who has submitted. It's someone who has recognized their own powerlessness. Jesus' first step is the same as the first step of AA. To recognize and to cultivate an attitude of poverty no matter where you are in life, whatever station that you have. This is what Jesus is calling us to. And then he says, "Blessed are these poor in spirit. Blessed are those who have this attitude of poverty. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven." But it goes deeper than that, because the sense of this phrase that has been translated, "for theirs is the kingdom," as Jesus states elsewhere, really means, "for such as these are the kingdom of heaven." They don't inherit the kingdom. They are the kingdom. Big difference. When we can move into this surrendered position, when we can move into this attitude of humility and dependence, and even wonder and joy, we are the kingdom that Jesus is talking about. We are living a life that has moved in a new direction. All of these things that we think define us, all of these things that we carry around, we can start to let go of because they are no longer the source of the illusion of our control that is so necessary when the world seems to be spinning out of control everywhere else we look. For me, as I look back on my life and I realize it took me at least 15 years to even start to understand that there was another way to live, boy, I hope that I can help cut that time down a little bit for any of you. And that's exactly what Jesus was trying to do, is to cut down the amount of time that it takes for us to start to get it. We can conceive of a new way to live if we can start to let go of the things that we're holding on to. We love our misery and we don't even know it. We say we want to change. We say that we want to move in a different direction, but really we're holding on to that last thing that is holding us back, but that gives us some sense of security. Jesus and the first step are showing us that there is a possibility, a truth that really can set us free. But until we take that first step, until we start to truly lay down, not just give up, but lay down our arms, lay down. We can't go any further. And we will be carrying around this weight with us wherever we go. And it'll compromise everything that we are trying to do. Jeff was talking about slips and relapses. It's always a possibility for any one of us. But the possibility decreases with every moment that we can spend in kingdom. With every moment that we can realize that there's another there out there that the Lord is calling us to. And when we experience Him, when we experience the Spirit of God, first person, the risk that we feel about life, the risk that we feel about the afterlife, the risk that we feel in general starts to fall away because we realize there's nothing to fear. There's nothing to fear in God. Amen. You know, there is no risk, but we won't know that until we taste and see that the Lord is good. And the psalm says, taste and see, not sit and think. It's taste and see. It's experiential. This is what the first step is calling us to do. So all of you who are working through your steps, those first three steps, to realize that your power is an illusion, that your life is unmanageable, that there is a God out there who cares for you, who can bring your life back into sanity if you will just give your will over to that power. Those first three steps form this cohesive unit that makes possible everything downstream from that. Take seriously this first step. Think about what it is that is the last thing that you are clinging to and need to let go of. Identify what that is. And if it's your misery, think about why you're still holding on to it and lay that down too. And you'll be amazed at what the world can look like in a very short period of time. And then if your old boyfriend or girlfriend calls you up, they may see a difference in your demeanor. Thanks for letting me share.